Select your program.
Dialogue.
Program initiated.
Approach the threshold. Engage rationality. Open your mind. Godspeed.
Beaming down to your listening devices, this is Flagship Freedom, the podcast that places you on the front line in the war of ideas. This is Michael.
And I'm Danny Boy.
And we are here to bring you a fantastic new episode, the second of our dialogue series, with a very special guest, one of whom many of you will surely know, the amazing, the incredible Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. We give a little bit more of an intro when we are actually within the call, so you can hear a little bit about what he is if you do not know about him, but we definitely encourage you to look him up during or even after the conversation, because he is a very prolific writer, he is an author, he is a lecturer, a lot on YouTube, a lot on his website, liberty.me. And we had a fantastic conversation that goes from really his approach and his way of delivering the message of liberty to the election, to history and Trump and the Libertarian Party. Man, Danny, I'm really excited to share this with everyone.
Fantastic guy, fun to talk to, met him in person before, and he brings a refreshing new perspective. So very valuable conversation.
Right. Well, we won't hold you any longer. Here we go. We are here with the founder and chief liberty officer of Liberty.me, policy advisor at Heartland Institute, the director of digital development for Foundation of Economic Education, a research fellow at the Acton Institute. There's a Michigan organization for you right there, an adjunct scholar for the Mackinac Institute. There's another Michigan Institute, and the editor of Laissez-Faire Books. He has authored several books himself and over 100 introductions to books and more articles than I can really count. He's been on Stossel. He's been on Beck. He's appeared frequently on Huffington Post Live, Mercy Me, and Russia Today. And look, guys, if you don't know him, you probably should. Mr. Jeffrey Tucker, welcome to the flagship.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much. You said something nice about Michigan. Does this mean that you're in Michigan?
We are, yes. We're located in the Detroit area. But
okay.
You just blew our cover. Now we're going to be in a FEMA camp. We're done for.
Well, that's really interesting. You know, lately I've been experimenting with being a football fan. Do you do that sort of thing?
Experiment with being fans of a variety of things?
No, being a fan.
Football, Mike.
Football. I like the culture around football, and I like watching it from time to time. Experimenting? I don't know. I guess so.
Yeah, I've been dabbling in it recently. Like this last Sunday, I watched two football games, and you know, it's just a marvelous, just like a presentation of color and drama and liturgical ceremony and athleticism and technology. It's all just kind of a beautiful. I mean, the more you look at it, the more intriguing it gets. Anyway, I ask that because it's my understanding that people who live in and around Detroit are fans of the Lions. Is that right?
You got that right. Yeah. For better or for worse.
Yeah. So there you go. I'm a Packers fan. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, no, that's fine. I mean, we welcome all sorts of people on this program. And personally, myself, I'm not one of those people that'll be at the throats of other people across the pond, so to speak. So
okay, it's just a game to you. That's good.
Yeah. It is. I mean, I grew up with a lot of Detroit fans. Then when I went to school on the west side of the state, we had just as many Lions fans as we would have Packers fans. So I was used to that whole thing.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, the Packers fans. It's very interesting that I found it intriguing because I went to the bar the other day and there were some Packers fans that came in, and I'm now identifying as a Packers fan, as I said. So I immediately felt this bond with these cheeseheads, and we're buying each other shots and, talking about Wisconsin culture or something. And I don't know, it was just a funny, it's just a funny thing how this works. I mean, we all strive throughout our lives, try to figure out like what is my connection to the stranger? You know, what is my entry point? You know, how can I bond with this person at a deeper level? And it's not so easy to do.
Yeah.
There aren't too many cultural institutions that sort of permit that. I mean, you experience this all the time. You know, you go to the store and you meet somebody, you know, kind of nice in the checkout line, but then you don't have a way to sort of continue the relationship, really. I mean, our relationships tend to be transitory in a way, and much to our regret. So we try to come up with these institutions and these ideas to, intensify and prolong our friendship networks. And it occurred to me Sunday that actually sports is one way we do it. You know, like, I'm just saying this because, otherwise these people would just be bar patrons and it would be like, oh, there's some people and that's it. But because, you know, we're both wearing, packaged paraphernalia, suddenly we believe that it's probably illusory, you know, but we believe we have some deeper connection together that, sure enough, you know, entitles us to spend money on each other, to hug each other, to, you know, after a football, to, you know, after a touchdown, to agree to meet up later for the next game. And, you know, that's kind of nice. I mean, and I wonder if that's a kind of part of the social utility of sports in a way, you know, that it gives us that opportunities for intensification of what otherwise would just be relationships with strangers, you know.
You know, that is incredible that you say that, because the first thing that I wanted to touch upon was the whole reason why I was drawn to a lot of your work and your writing in the first place. Danny and I have been longtime fans, Danny more so than myself, because I'm more of a neophyte when it comes to the Liberty Movement, although I flirted with it for just about my whole entire life. When I started reading your work and watching your lectures, it was remarkable how you came across as someone who could empathize, and you built the conversation through writing and through speaking, through empathy and compassion upon the subjects, whether they disagree with you or not. And the stereotype of libertarians is that sort of Randian hero, very cold, calculating, and difficult to penetrate. And you have a style that is so inviting. And even the lectures, Capitalism is Love, really provocative title, a really interesting lecture we'll post in the show notes. But your style is so much different than a lot of other libertarians whom I admire and respect, and you know, their style is very interesting, but yours is one that I was immediately drawn to.
Well, I thank you for saying that. That means something. It means a lot to me, actually. You know, I bumped into, I remember when I was very young, it was like after I became a libertarian, I believed that I had to be a certain kind of person as a result. You know, I don't know if you... I wonder if everybody goes through this. You know, when you suddenly identify as a certain political point of view, then you feel like you have to become something. And I watched an interview with myself. But God, I hope I never run across it again. I think I was like 23 or something like that. Yeah. And it was so strange to watch myself, because I had this, I don't even remember this guy, you know, but I had a little bit of a steely way and a little bit, how do you say, didactic, you know, like I used every opportunity in the interview to sort of deduce some, you know, truth. And it's creepy. I didn't know that I was ever that way. My only proof is this one video. Like I say that, I hope you never find. but I think that something happened to me. It's somewhere along the way where I was like, look, you know, I don't want liberty to be like a put on for me. You know, I don't want it to be something like a personality I adopted, or, you know, a persona that I decided to make my own because I didn't like the way I was before. You know, and, right. You know, human liberty is a big topic, and it presumably encompasses, you know, everything that's wonderful in life. And at some point, and I'm not sure where it was, I just decided that I was going to test my libertarianism against the person I really am, you know, whatever that is, and see if I could weave those together in some way, and see if my conviction and love for liberty survived that, you know what I mean?
And
it did. It did survive it, and so now I don't worry anymore. You know, I feel like it's not. Like my libertarianism or anarchism, whatever you would call it, is not anything that I it's not for me, you know, like something that's bolted on in any sense. I want to live and breathe it and believe it just as in my normal life, you know, not something I have to work to affect, but rather something that just, you know, it just exudes from the way I think and in all of my eccentricities, you know. And so that was a kind of a nice moment in my life where I felt like I could sort of integrate those two things and not worry about it. You know, I don't feel like I have to be Ayn Rand or some 19th century literary figure or even my friend Murray Rothbard, you know, who's very I'm just me. And I think that in a way, the beautiful thing about liberty is that it offers the opportunity for you to be who you are, you know? So part of really loving liberty is having a confidence that, you know, who you are is somebody dignified and somebody with rights and somebody who matters, and your outlook and perspective on life can actually contribute to a deepening of understanding of what liberty could mean to others. So yeah, I finally did come to that place in my life. So anyway, thank you for making that comment. That means a lot to me.
No,
yeah.
Go ahead, Dan.
Jeffrey, what I love most about your work is that very nature, is that you've sort of internalized liberty to the point where it's not, like you said, a thing that you bolt on. It is the world around us. It is actually most of society, and it's the state that is this extra apparatus. We're not advocating a system. We're just want to get along, you know, don't hit, don't steal, and everything else, you know, like you described, football and trade, it's all beautiful, you know, ways people are living out their lives and choosing their destiny. And that's something I've slowly been happening to me, is just the fusion of liberty. It's no longer a thing. It's just life.
Yeah, not some artificial intellectual construct, you know, that you sort of have to lug around with you. Yeah.
Enter liberty mode.
Yeah, I like the way you put that too, that the real things around us are extend from liberty, and the artificial things that, you know, really suck, many of them extend from this thing we call the state. And yeah, I like the way you phrase that, because that is truly the way I tend to look at the world, you know, and it's the way things make sense to me. And by the way, it's a lot easier to be a libertarian than, say, for example, be a Marxist. I mean, I don't know how a Marxist sort of goes through life, because everything you see, you'd think would like contradict your ideology, you know?
Yeah.
You go into Chick-fil-A and you have a yummy sandwich and it's served to you by a happy employee. And
then you have exploitation.
And then you have to correct yourself and go, oh, what am I thinking? That person's not happy. That person's actually looked it, you know.
Yeah.
Everything is exploitation.
Yeah, so that's why it seems so apt when Danny messaged me a while back, you know, when we were putting this whole interview together, and he's like, you got to read this, what Jeffrey wrote. It's this article, Why Politics is So Depressing. And I thought, only somebody that could be so honest and strip away all of the mass and the pretension and just talk about the fact that politics is removing me from the relationships, the pleasure of having, you know, people around me and doing things with people, instead of worrying about, you know, this guy's painted red or this guy's painted blue, which a lot of people have to think about and think about in the back of their heads all the time. Categories.
Yeah.
Instead, you know, we just like to enjoy everyone for their diversity of opinion and interests, and that's what you express in this article. You mentioned,
well, I'm not sure if it was obvious from the article at all, but you know, that piece really extended from an insight that I had that was very personal and almost autobiographical. And the fact is this, that starting from about June of 2015, I really became sort of rather intense about following politics and commenting on politics more than I ever had in my entire career. And what gave rise to it was it was watching Trump and seeing this very strange way in which this interwar ideological outlook that we thought was killed, you know, at the end of World War II or something, just kind of persists. And I got curious about what that means intellectually and ideologically. And so I looked really very closely and probably too closely. And it really did kind of shake me up a little bit, actually, because, you know, I found that I was, you know, I was making some very passionate commentary about Trump, and people didn't understand it, and I had to write more articles, and I feel like in the end I'm sort of vindicated. But along the way, I did actually strain some friendships, and I found, you know, for the first time in my entire sort of social media life, the need to ban people. So I'm banning people, you know, and I ended up having like 100, you know, 100 or maybe 130 or so bans on Facebook and Twitter. I was trolled on various sites. And I, for the first time in my life, really began to think, just however temporarily and slightly, about the world in terms of friends and enemies. And I noticed that it started affecting my outlook on life. You know, I mean, it's not a really very pleasant way to think. I think it actually diminishes your optimism and your sense of hope, and affects your heart and soul in some way. And I don't like what politics has done to me over the last year and a half. So that piece was a kind of like announcement in a way to myself. And I do a lot of my writing just to sort of talk to myself, like basically cut it out. You know, if you let this control you and affect your demeanor and your spirit, and your relationship with your fellow human beings, then you're letting the state have inordinate influence over something that's actually extremely important in your life, you know? And it's like you're letting them control you, you know? And I feel like I caught myself in a sense, like before I fell too far, you know? So that piece was kind of my net in a way, you know? So, and so I codified it in an article almost as a kind of a personal reminder, you know, don't let this happen to you. And it's sad to me because I feel like I was speaking for a lot of other people too. You know, I've noticed this with a lot of my friends. This has been a very, very difficult election year. It's challenged everything we thought we knew about our friendships and our parents and our teachers and our neighbors. And I think that's just a gravely unfortunate aspect of politics. And it strikes me as totally unnecessary. I mean, if we didn't have a state, we wouldn't have to worry about this nonsense. But I think it also does say something about how we conduct our lives. It's like, are you going to let your life, your quality of your own life, be diminished by this ridiculous charade, this absurd drama that's occurring outside of anything you can actually control? Are you going to let that happen to you, or are you going to push back against it and fight through it and have the stamina to look past politics and persevere in building a good life for yourself? I mean, that's what it comes down to for me.
Yeah, someone very, very near and dear to me is struggling with that same thing, as well as myself. He works in politics. He works for one of the political organizations here in Michigan, and he finds his beliefs at odds with the people that are surrounding him and his duties all the time. And I can't imagine the struggle he has to endure to reconcile these two things. And you know, often is the case on this program, you may or may not know that at the very end of the program, we always refer to the war of ideas. So it's kind of bellicose in that sense. But always it's my identification of the metaphysical war, not an actual physical fight with the people, right, but the ideas.
Yep.
And often I see the conflation of the ideas and the people, and the person is the embodiment of the idea. So therefore, let's attack the people. It's easy, it's expeditious, and let's be done with it. And I've got my own teams. I've got my own friends. I don't need to show compassion. I don't need to show empathy. But this is something that, you know, occasionally I struggle with, and I see it all the time, more and more and more, you know, up until November and perhaps even after, because half the population is going to be pretty darn angry, I imagine.
Yeah, I know what you mean. This bombing, I thought about this the other day. It's like, look, you opened up the show with characterizing your views and mine and a good libertarian way of thinking as being thinking of the things that happen all around us as an extension of freedom and anarchy and our capacity as individuals to build a good life for ourselves, and the state as an external artificial thing. And I like that's the way I prefer to think about the world. The problem is, this election has reminded us of a sort of something terrible, which is that, you know, under sort of the democratic nation states that we have right now, the government invades our spaces in ways that are really unfortunate, you know. And I'm afraid that this election has been, to some extent, like culturally damaging for us, you know, as a people. And I worry about the outcome of the election either way. What was a warning sign to me the other day was when the North Carolina headquarters of the Trump campaign was firebombed, you know, and some people threw bottles in the room that said, you know, get out Nazis, you know, right. And that was interesting to me because it makes you wonder, you know, like I began to imagine in my own head, you know, like what if Trump wins? I mean, there's going to be 100,000 protesters permanently stationed outside, you know, the White House, shutting down traffic in Washington, D.C. I mean, there's probably going to be a lot of things going on in this country. You know, more firebombings, more protests. The daily news coverage is going to be insufferable. But, you know, basically what you have here is that you have a lot of people, very good people on the left, who are rightly very concerned about the rise of sort of brown-shirted ideology in this country. The problem is that if you think that this is sort of a millenarian epic struggle between good and evil, at some point, any means is justified to defeat the foe, you know, and it actually, for the first time after the other day, I actually worried about, you know, what our country is going to look like. And under a Trump presidency, are we going to be dealing with, you know, ongoing sort of politically oriented violence, you know, like Northern Ireland or something, you know, a half a century ago? I don't know, but it's possible. And then you have to like sort of roll the alternative scenario. With Hillary Clinton wins, you know, what are the Trump people? How entrenched are they in sort of Trumpish ideology and wild conspiracy theories and sort of brown-shirted aspirations for the national community and so on? How intense do they feel about those things? Is it to the point that, again, anything is justified in the name of getting rid of, you know, Hillary Clinton, the wicked internationalist, paragon of establishment corruption. You know, I don't know, but it's in either case, you know, we have more to worry about than just who's going to be in charge. We have to worry about the opposition to whoever's in charge too. You know, that's pretty weird. It's weird to think of.
On that subject, Jeffrey, you mentioned the sort of the rise of brown shirtedness, so to speak, and I know that you have expressed some disappointment as well as we have about just the way that even the libertarian community has been swept in to this Trump nationalism. And I wonder if you could offer any insight as to, help us understand how we seem to have backslid so far into it almost, I know people are going to hate this comparison, but it just reminds me of pre-World War II Germany, where the population just gets swept into this frothy mix of resentment. And I mean, that seems to be a recurring theme in politics. Yeah,
that's not an unjust comparison. And if you've ever gone to, a Holocaust museum in D.C. or Berlin or anything, you understand that it actually, you know, the Hitler didn't start as Hitler. The Holocaust didn't just, you know, happen. I mean, it was a result of 15 years of gradual dehumanization of a population and sort of a deeply warped ideology sort of gradually taking over communities a little bit at a time. So I don't think that's an unjust comparison. I mean, the question is a good one. It's like, and your reference to libertarians is fascinating because I think you have noticed, I've noticed, I think we've all noticed that there's certain sectors of libertarianism seem to have been unprepared to resist what Trump represents. And I think that was a gradual process. Ultimately, my friends, I really do think it comes down to a certain intellectual naivety, ideological naivety. The libertarian personality was formed in the post-war period as something that passionately opposed left socialism. I mean, that was always been our core, you know. Mm-hmm. look at the Soviet Union. We don't want to go that way. Look at these crazy left-wing professors on campus and the way they want to nationalize industry. Look at these egalitarians and the way they want to redistribute the welfare state. Look at these anti-capitalists in the media and Hollywood and the way they have insufficient appreciation for the contribution of private enterprise, you know, to productivity. And this has been a kind of our animating story. It's the template that we've told ourselves this again and again. And I think gradually over the decades, libertarianism became really defined by a sort of an anti-leftist orientation exclusively. And in the course of this, what happened is we failed to sort of look the other direction and go, well, what are the dangers from the right? What do they look like? And what are the signs of that? Mm. And when it came along, I just think that people are just not prepared to recognize it. Now, I must tell you that for me personally, I think maybe 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I would not have been as inclined to understand what was going on as I was last summer when I first called this out. And the reason that I was so alert to understanding what Trumpism represents was because I just finished reading Ludwig Mises' 1944 book called Omnipotent Government. Mm-hmm. Now, so think about the time when this was written. Now Mises was a lifetime anti-socialist, right? So he wrote the big book against socialism in 1922. He covered syndicalism, Christian socialism, welfarism, the rise of Bismarck, redistributionism, crazy medieval experiments in communism, and so on. And he just shattered the whole ideology. And it was awesome. The one thing he didn't really anticipate was the rise of sort of socialist forms within a different cultural framework, namely a right-wing cultural framework that purported to be pro-property, pro-religion, and pro-national community. He's writing in 1922, all right? So he couldn't quite, foresee the future perfectly. But he lived through it. And it was astonishing for him because, he'd been fighting the communists, essentially, intellectually fighting them throughout the 1920s, which who were a very legitimate and dangerous threat to Italy and Spain and Germany and Austria. And then there arose in the late 1920s and early 1930s an opposition force that generally was National Socialist or fascistic or whatever you want to call it, post-syndicalist, rightist form of collectivism that purported to be anti-communist, like in other words, his natural allies. So he had to sort of deal with a question like, do I hate communism so much so I'm willing to link arms with these jerks, And his answer was essentially no. And then incredibly, from his point of view, in 1934, he's looking out of at his office window and he sees brown shirts marching up and down the streets going, kill the Jews, out with the Jews, get rid of the Jews, and especially Jewish liberals, which, he was one. And he realized he had to get the hell out of Dodge, which he did. And he escaped to Geneva with his fiance. And then all of Europe went up in flames. Jews were driven out of every country. They were not allowed into the U.S. because we had strict immigration controls. Eventually rounded up in ghettos, food runs out, they find every method for inventing these killing machines, and it was just a bloody catastrophe. So he was in Geneva from 1934 to 1940, during which time he wrote this gigantic book called Human Action. And it was a book of pure economic theory. Now, I just can't even imagine the sort of, monkish contemplative mental state he had to enter into in order to write this book, because the book is weirdly detached from European politics at the time. So he comes out with the book, it comes out in German, 1944. Hardly anybody read it. And then he was driven out of Geneva. Look, we got too many Jewish liberals around here, get the hell out. So he comes to New York, he's 60 years old. And now he has time to reflect on the fullness of his ideological outlook. And he realizes that he had minimized, that he had not fully understood the dangers to the human liberty, that he thought it was mostly from the left. Now it turns out that collectivism or statism, as he called it, for the first time in 1944, is a threat, no matter what the ideological package it comes wrapped in from a cultural point of view. So he writes a full-scale treatise now in 1944 against the Nazis and against the fascists. And it's almost as long as his original book on the socialists. And he identifies all these parts and pieces to this ideology. So it starts with protectionism. We've got to build up a national community, a you know, homogeneous front against dangerous foreigners. So protectionism, immigration restrictions are naturally part of it. Eugenics, he has a whole chapter in there on that subject. And about this, and then the strong man, you know, who's going to use a business orientation to kind of unify the nation and a single, to march in a single direction, right? So he's got, so I read this book and I was riveted by it, even though I think I'd read it before. I'd read this book like just a month before hearing Trump speak. So when Trump opens his mouth, you know, in July, I guess it was July 2015 when I heard him speak, it was so weird to me because I had this book as a sort of a lens, you know, through which to understand him. And sure enough, he just began to, wittingly or unwittingly, I don't know, but he just began to sort of play the part of the characters in this book. And that's what blew my mind. I said, and so then I blew the whistle. I wrote the article for Newsweek magazine, and I just began to talk about it. This guy's a fascist. Fascism is real. Fascism is an ideology. It's a species of socialism sold under a right-wing cultural fabric. Look out. This is the strong man from interwar Europe that we always dreaded. Don't be fooled, you know. And I just really began to write very aggressively about this. And here's the thing. I don't think that other libertarians are really prepared at that point to see what I was referring to, that what I was talking about, just because they hadn't really been properly inoculated, I think, or prepared to see the dangers that were in front of them. And I think a lot of libertarians saw this businessman going, yeah, down with the establishment, boo on the left, you know, down with political correctness, you know, the government's corrupt. And they thought, huh, wow, that must be our guy. He's saying a lot of stuff similar to what we say. And they just weren't sophisticated enough to see through the rhetoric, essentially. I think that's more or less what happened.
Yeah. Dr. Ron Paul is a remarkable individual, and over the past 10 years, he's done more things that I could possibly imagine that I could do for libertarianism and a free society. But one of the things that I've noticed, maybe a consequence that he hadn't anticipated, nor I don't think anybody could, is that he created, as I imagine it, a bubble that lifted everyone up, and he pulled people from many different groups. He pulled it from the voluntarists and the free society members and the anarchists and the classical liberals, and he also pulled from anti-establishment. He pulled people from the kinds of people that like to flick off the government or to flick off whatever's in charge at the time. These are people that may not have an intellectual foundation or an ethical foundation for their ideas. Rather, they are just opposed to whatever is majoritarian at the time. And perhaps it is that, you know, him running, you know, under the clothing of a Republican, it pulled people into thinking that perhaps libertarianism was a rightist sort of thing. And yeah. Then what ended up happening is that, you know, 10 years later, or even, four, 6 years later, we have somebody of a different nature, of a different kind, that is pulling from a lot of different pockets. And some of these people never had that sophisticated understanding or that nuanced understanding of libertarianism. It's just an anti-establishment sort of thing. They liked that in Ron Paul, and they like it in Donald Trump. And
that's right.
And that's what I've seen.
No, I think you're exactly right. And to Ron's credit, actually, Ron has been alert to the Trump threat from the very beginning. I mean, he told many interviews, he's told people, look, this guy's an authoritarian of the rightist sort, you know. And Ron has been very good on this issue, but it's so funny that that his own movement, large swaths of his own movement, didn't actually listen to him. You know, they just kind of went on following the Pied Piper, you know, Trump. And now, of course, they're going over the cliff, you know. So it's very sad. They should have listened to Ron all along. But yeah, I think you're right. It's this sort of this confusion between, you know, yeah, we hate the establishment. Okay, we get that.
Yeah.
But the question is, you know, what do we love? You know?
Yes.
And that's a different and much more difficult issue. And I think that the Ron Paul movement, you know, given how quickly it was cobbled together and, you know, all the frenzy that surrounded it, oftentimes just forgot, you know, what it is, you know, forgot to love, you know, forgot to forget what it is we're striving to achieve. And if you don't ask that sort of fundamental question, you can easily, how do you say, see your movement co-opted. And I think that's sort of what Trump has accomplished to some extent. I don't know to what extent, not entirely, because actually another strange thing has happened this year is that we've seen for the first time in my lifetime, you know, the rise of a sort of a viable libertarian party voice, you know, with the Johnson Weld campaign. And that's been fascinating for me to watch because, you know, Gary is a you know, a different sort of libertarian than you find, you know, coming out of the Ron Paul world.
Right.
And yet I think he's arguably solidly within the liberal tradition, broadly considered. And I like him. I think he's a really nice guy. But oddly, one of the things I like about Gary and the movement that has surrounded him is precisely that there's really no personality cult around Johnson himself. You know, I mean, nobody thinks he's going to save the world, you know, with his, you know, prophetic powers or, you know, managerial prowess. He's just a sort of a nice dude that just thinks that things work better without violence. You know, I mean, that's more or less, you know, the fullness of his perspective. I actually think that's a decent message, really. Well, I mean, if you can sort of decompress a little bit and just listen to what he has to say, you'll find that as a libertarian, you'll agree with most everything he says. And sometimes I think we expect too much of our political leaders. I mean, I think that's good. Maybe that's all we need, you know, to push history in the right direction.
Yeah, he's had an amazing influence. I've watched people in my life who I thought never would have gone in that direction, but it's as a defensive move, because finally, in my opinion, the silver lining of this election is it's very clear. You're stuck between two terrible choices, and that's really the illusion of choice at this point. So I think that's one positive thing, at least.
You know, I had a funny thing happen to me about and, you know, I mean, we all grow and evolve slowly. And I'm certainly in that situation. But I remember, I think it was 2 years ago, I went to a conference in New York called Liberty Fest, which was basically built on the remnants of the 2012 Ron Paul effort and all these, you know, ANCAPs and everybody's sort of edgy and radical and smoking too much weed and, you know, all the usual stuff. And I showed up and Gary Johnson was speaking, and I remember sitting out there, you know, drinking a beer. I'm thinking, I'm just going to say it. I mean, I just thought, I don't need to hear this kind of milk toast, you know, libertarianism now. You know, it's the last thing I want to hear is a lecture by a dude that, doesn't want to abolish the state, you know, which somehow thinks he can use politics to improve it. So I was prepared to sit out the lecture, even though Gary's a nice guy, but I think I spoke before him and so on my way leaving the stage, Gary sort of grabs me and says, "Oh my God, I've always wanted to be your friend. I've always wanted to meet you. I've always wanted to get to know you. I love your work. It means so much to me. And I hope that we get a chance tonight to hang out. And let me just say what an honor it is." Well, I was a little bit taken aback by this, right? I was like, oof, you know, given what I was just thinking a little bit ago, you know, I'm kind of a jerk here. So then I thought, well, the least I could do is just be nice and listen to him. So I did. And it was probably that personal contact more than anything that just helped me sort of like chill for a little bit. And, you know, he began to talk about, you know, the problems of the public school system and how you need more choice and the taxes are far too high and it's too difficult, you know, to start a business in this country. And and how we need the government to stop, you know, caring about what we're doing in the bedroom. And, you know, he was saying a bunch of like what you could as a libertarian regard as sort of platitudes in a way, you know, I mean, it's like stuff that doesn't like energize, you know, those of us that are all in with the ideological structure. Right. But I tried my best to sit there and listen as if I were a normal person for a few minutes. And at that moment, I thought, you know what? I can think of a lot of people that need to hear this message, actually, that would be challenged by it. And it might be their moment of enlightenment. So I sat it out all the way to the end. And by the end of the talk, I thought, you know, this guy is kind of awesome. He makes a lot of sense. He's selling liberty. What he says is true. I don't agree with everything, right. but generally he's on the right track. And I just thought, you know, our political culture could do for a little bit of this common sense pro-freedom attitude, you know? And maybe that was the moment at which I began to kind of like try to think more broadly about my responsibilities, you know, as a public intellectual, not just my own friendship network or my fan base, but really to the whole of where we're going as a society. And I thought maybe Gary could make a contribution. So when it came time for him to run, you know, as a libertarian nominee, I was not his backer. I backed McAfee because, you know, McAfee is all edgy and, you know, loving the dark net and drugs. And, you know, I go for that crap. I mean, I'm a sucker for anarchism, you know? So, you know, I hung out with him, I cheered him on. And yet, I gotta tell you, you know, in the end, when Johnson won, part of me just said, you know what? The party made the responsible choice today. And I think I look back on that day and think, you know, that it's true. I mean, if it had been McAfee, and God bless him, we love him. But can you imagine if you know, with a Clinton and a Trump and the alternative of McAfee, I'm just not sure that things would have gone as well as they've gone this year. I mean, we now in our – we actually have a viable third party. I can't believe I'm even saying that. You know, it's actually amazing to consider.
Those who have been listening to this program know that I've been a little lukewarm when it comes to Governor Johnson, because some of the things that he's said, of course, you know, I don't expect to agree with everyone 100% of the time. And I think perhaps it is the purist in me that wants to hear him describe libertarianism not so much as fiscally conservative and socially liberal as I've heard him say. I don't want him to sound like a pedagogue. I understand that the message needs to be marketable. And then the idea, when the rubber meets the road, how much are we sacrificing? Should we sacrifice to become a viable candidate? So when he says things about gun control, and you know, he was supporting the anti-burqa policy in southern. Southern France municipality and Planned Parenthood federal funding. These are the kinds of things that make me, you know, my hair stand on end. Is that a natural response to what he's saying, and not necessarily, you know, a knock on his personality or a knock on his strategy, because he is trying to become a marketable, genuine, honest individual? Because I can't imagine that. You know, Dr. Paul would say these things.
Right.
But it's not Dr. Paul. This is a different person. It's a different person. Yeah.
And the one thing to say about Gary actually is that, and I think it's to his credit, he doesn't say these things because he thinks that he has to compromise with principle in order to achieve some sort of political viability. He's actually speaking from his heart. I mean, you know, he's a little squeamish on some of the topics that you and I are like, you know, totally, you know, good with. You know, I'm really happy for, you know, if the market's going to give us methamphetamine vending machines on every corner, I'm totally, you know, I'm good with that. I mean, you know, I really, I'm ready for all out liberty, right? That's not his temperament. That's not his personality. That's not who he is. In a sense, all of his compromises with libertarianism extend from actually what is a very interesting sort of impulse he has towards a kind of humane liberalism in a way. And that can be you know, like for example, on the Nazi cake bit, you know, now his point there was interesting. He didn't himself feel like it was the time to take on the issue of the freedom to discriminate on grounds of religion, and his reasoning is that he's sort of more personally mortified by this rise of anti-Islamic attitudes in this country. And I don't know if he said this publicly or if it was just to me privately, but he said, if you have a kind of a Muslim enclave that's dependent upon a public power company that's privatized, you know, to provide all of its sewage and electricity, and those people are sort of whipped up in a frenzy and say, you know what, we're just going to starve these people out. We're going to cut off their electricity and cut off their sewage. Right. He says, as a chief executive, he wants to be able to say, look, these people have rights same as anybody else. You can't do that. And that was really the case that he made to me for saying this is not the right time to affirm, you know, the right of religious discrimination, you know, in the midst of this kind of problem, because human lives could actually suffer as a result. So, like, I don't think I agree with him on this point, but I appreciate the rationale and the humane concern from which it extends. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. I understand. When I see him on camera, when I listen to him, I do sense an honesty and an integrity that I don't see in many, many, many other politicians, 99% of them. And that is important to me. And I think that that's important to a lot of people, but perhaps they see the Aleppo bit and they're like, oh, well, you know what? I need to choose somebody that can either actually win or that doesn't flub. And who doesn't flub? Come on.
I know. You know, that Aleppo thing was hilarious to me because the week before, because I'm the editor of fee.org, right?
So I'm
kind of the gatekeeper to what appears there and what doesn't. And I had submitted to me an article that was called something like, what should we do about Aleppo? And my response to the author was, I'm sorry. I don't even know what Aleppo is. Nobody cares. I can't run this beast. That was really my response.
Yeah.
And then a week later, you know, I see that I feel like maybe if I had run that article, that Gary would have known what Aleppo was, and we could have been spared.
Yeah, Jeffrey, you're not fit to be president. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It's over. If you had any ambitions.
People were chomping at the bit, but that's absolutely true. Nobody knows the capital of every single country at the drop of a hat. You can't possibly. And I think people know that in their heart of hearts. Like, come on, dude. The guy's got a million things on his mind.
Well, and the irony of that that so-called gaffe was that it was the first big national attention he received. So, I guess I feel really warm towards Gary. Probably more personally than anything else. But I immediately dropped him a note after I saw this. I said, Gary, I know you think this is the worst day of your life, but you know, sometimes history takes different directions, and it could be that this was the beginning of your national exposure. You're not going to get into the debates. So maybe it's just the way history is unfolding that, you know, the way you get into the national press is by this kind of flub. So this could be the greatest thing that ever happened to you.
Yeah.
And he wrote me back and said, you know, I was feeling so bad for myself right now, and this your note arrived. So I just want to say thank you. That was nice.
You have a very favorable opinion of the Libertarian Party, from what I understand, and you do seem to think, or it does seem, and don't allow me to put words in your mouth, but it does seem like you have a belief that there can be action through the political system, a sort of amelioration of some of the miseries that are going on.
Maybe,
And I was listening to an interview, or perhaps it was on his program, but Jeff Deist of Mises, he was talking about how he is a reluctant supporter of the party and has sympathies for a lot, or at least empathy for a lot of people that thought that the Libertarian Party should have never existed in the first place, that the Libertarians should have simply you know, infiltrated or just grown into the Republican or the Democrat party and made it work that way, because then they're pulling votes from one or the other. And but he understood also perhaps the need for an identity, just a separate entity that represents not the right and the left. And is that something that you would agree with
Murray Rothbard himself had to deal with this back when the party was founded. It was around the same time as his New York Times editorial, where I think it was called something like the New Libertarianism, you know, and why it's significant. He wrote this New York Times editorial, and then got a commission from some big publisher to write his Libertarian Manifesto. And the party was founded around the same time. And Rothbard wrote a big memo opposing the party because he said, look, this is terrible. If you do this, everybody will be judging the status of libertarian ideology based on our election returns. And the fact is we have a two-party system, and this is just a disaster in the making. So he was really against it. But then the party founded anyway, and he came around and he changed his view. And then his new view was that, look, Americans are funny people. We don't care anything about philosophy, actually. Nobody cares anything about ideas until election season comes once every 4 years. People, you know, ask themselves, gosh, what do I believe? What do you think the government should do? What is the role of the state relative to the individual liberty? Because it becomes a pressing personal matter for people. How are they going to cast their vote? So he said, if we don't, his new view is that if we don't enter into this realm, libertarian ideas will never get a hearing and will be considered, you know, permanently marginalized. So then he threw himself into Libertarian Party activism. I kind of get the both points he's making in a way, but you know, I gotta tell you guys, you know, when I think about this, you know, it's like it's been a hard slog, 40 years of the Libertarian Party. You know, every 4 years, it's another, you know, terrible struggle to get ballot access, you know. And I don't know if you've ever been to Libertarian Party meetings, but they're just terrible. I mean, you have to sit around all day, you know, in these discussions and meetings, and there's all these Robert's Rules of Order, and there's these documents, these votes, and it's like, God, who can stand this stuff? Some people love it, whatever, I don't. And I think about just the amount of time and energy and everything that was put into sustaining this machinery, this apparatus over 40 years, I mean, nearly half a century. It's just shocking to me. And yet, at the end of the day, here it is, 2016, and we desperately needed a voice for sanity in the last year. And there was the good old Libertarian Party, you know, just actually playing its appointed role in history to represent a liberal alternative to two forms of authoritarianism. And I'm just as proud as I can be of every activist for the last half century who's dedicated them to themselves to building and sustaining this institution. I feel like it's a lesson to all of us, you know, like the payoff for our activism might not be this year, it might not be in 10 years, it might take 50 years, but eventually the things we're doing today will pay off in a decisive and critical way for the future of humanity itself. So I think we owe a debt to all these people that so many of us have made fun of and rolled our eyes at, and you know, I mean, look what they're doing, look what's happening. You know, it's a beautiful thing. We can't know the future. We don't know how history is going to unfold. And one of the things that I think the Trump movement does teach us is that the implausible can actually happen. If there's enough passion and energy behind it, crazy stuff can happen. Like this, you know, billionaire, you know, PR man, you know, would be able to plow through the whole Republican establishment and get the nomination. And if that can happen, then a lot of other things can happen too.
I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable. That's right. I mean, so it seems like the Libertarian Party to you is like a rallying point for future effort and sort of that point on the distance that we should all be striving for.
And I say this based on a look back at history. Like if you look at the end of the age of laissez-faire, so something like between the 1860s and World War One, the way you see political parties falling out all over the developed industrialized West is that there were three parties always. There was Labor, there was Tory, and there was Liberal. So Labor always represented a kind of redistributionist, you know, egalitarian, provide a lot of welfare kind of perspective. The Tories represented the old line establishment, the sort of revanchist, reactionary brand of aristocratic protectionist, you know, we have our industries, we know who our people are, let's stop change, you know, and be restorative in our outlook. And that's basically the left and the right, you know, that was the way it unfolded in 19th century. And then you had, as the third alternative, the Liberal Party in all nations. And the Liberals represented a love of free trade, free migration, free markets, civil liberties, peace as an ideal, free speech, an optimistic view towards the capacity of multifarious religious traditions to coexist within a single society, a view of the social order that was didn't have an end in sight, but rather and experimentation and technology and that sort of thing. That's what the Liberals of the 19th century believed, and they were a present force in 19th century politics. In 20th century politics, the Liberals were practically extinguished, you know, for a large part of the century. Until the 1980s, really, and then you saw the Liberals come emerge from within the structure of two Tory parties in the US and the UK with the Thatcher and Reagan movements. And so we had to kind of coexist with them for a couple of decades. But now, so I'm actually excited. We've finally broke apart from these people and we can be our own voice again. And I think that's a very big moment of clarity and maybe a new beginning for us.
That actually makes me feel a little bit more optimistic.
That's good.
I mean, there you go, Jeffrey. I mean, I have a little bit to think about now. I know we're running into the last couple minutes of our discussion, and my goodness, we could probably talk for several more hours because there's so much both Danny and I would like to cover, but perhaps at another time. Firstly, I'd like to say thank you so much for joining us in our conversation. It means a lot to us and our fledgling podcasts, and hopefully our listeners will appreciate it as much and enjoy it as much as we did. But before we go, I do want to end on a tangential note, which is, you may or may not know, I am a filmmaker, and I always like to ask people, just as a conversation starter or finisher, what is your favorite movie? Jeffrey,
wow,
what is your favorite
movie?
That
is a huge question. I mean, I can't even answer. I love Gladiator, actually. It's one of my favorites.
Really?
But I tell you, the movie that nobody has seen that I just highly recommend is a movie from the 1970s called Reds. And it's a history of the Bolsheviks in America. And I love the movie.
Yeah, is that Jack Nicholson?
Yeah. It's an awesome film. I could watch it 1,000 times. Let me say, since we're closing out, thank you both for letting me talk so much. I talk more than I should at too great a length, but I appreciate your indulgence. It means a lot to me, and I'm very proud to share this interview with my network. So thank you.
It's our pleasure.
If one thing I've realized every time I refresh myself on your work is I think your approach is the best. That is to not approach people with hostility and this is we, us versus them mentality, but you find the commonality among everybody. You find what people care about and you embrace them wherever they are. So that's one thing I a very valuable lesson for me. I'm one of the worst offenders. Sometimes I just can't keep my cool.
Yes, you are.
Yes. We all are. No, right. I'm not sure. Of
but you're really doing amazing work, and you will go down in history. I guarantee you that. So thank you so much for the incredibly valuable effort that you've poured your life's energy into towards the liberation of mankind. It's really important, and I'm sure people listen to this for years and hopefully decades to come. So thank you for your service.
You're flattering us with that more than Jeffrey, I think. People listen to this more than after the first time, Danny.
Well, yeah, we have to pat ourselves on the back every now and then. It's an uphill battle often unrewarding, but we all know why we're in it, and just keep our eye on the prize. We'll get there.
Right.
That's right. That's right. So, Jeffrey, if people want to follow you, follow your work, where shall we direct them to?
Yeah, fee.org is, I think, at this point, the best place. I'd love it if you join Liberty Me. I've built up a big library there. My Twitter account is active. I have an official Facebook page, so I'm not far away, you know, from anybody's keyboard. So just give it a Google and you'll find me.
Yeah, we have to make an account there. Danny, that's on our to-do list right there, liberty.me.
Yeah, that's good. It's a lot of literature. It's free. I started it as a business, sold it to a nonprofit, so I'm very pleased about what's emerged there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I browsed it a bit, and it is a wealth of knowledge. So I encourage the listeners to take a look at it, and then we'll get on there too, and then the listeners can interact with us. So
good.
Jeffrey, thank you once again for all the time that you spent with us, and we hope to be able to do this in the future.
I like that idea. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a great day. We'll talk to you. Only one desire,
and that one desire is you. And I know nobody else ain't gonna do it.